Welcome, friends. James Corbett here, CorbettReport.com. It is the 26th of June, 2013. Today, I'm joined on the line from Kuala Lumpur by our old friend and good friend of the Corbett Report, Niall Bowie, of course, the photojournalist slash reporter who's there on the scene in Malaysia and whose work is appearing in more and more outlets online, not just Press TV and Global Research, but now places like Counterpunch, and he's writing op-edge columns for RT.com, so he is getting around there in a big way, and I'm glad to see that. Niall Bowie, it's great to have you back on the program.
Always a pleasure to be here, James, and always great to talk to you and contribute to Corbett Report.
Excellent. Well, it's good to have you here from Kuala Lumpur, where I understand things are not so pleasant in the past few days because of some air pollution issues, but we'll suffer through the smog and try to clear some of the fog as it comes to international politics. And I want to start today by picking up on an extremely, extremely important subject that is getting almost zero attention, even in the alternative media, but that you are covering there on your blog, once again, nilebowie.blogspot.com, and that's the Trans-Pacific Partnership, a major trade deal that is in the process of taking place and taking shape right now between a lot of the Asia-Pacific nations, but is taking place almost completely under lock and key and behind closed doors. So I definitely want to talk about this issue in some detail today. People who are interested can see one of your recent columns on this Trans-Pacific Partnership neoliberal arm of Obama's Asia pivot. But before we start talking about some of the geopolitical ramifications of this, etc., why don't we make sure everyone's on the same page by just telling them a little bit about what the TPP is and why it is so worrying?
Okay, well, the Trans-Pacific Partnership follows in the same line of thinking as the NAFTA free trade agreements and other various free trade agreements organized between the very powerful countries in the West and several smaller economies throughout the world. So in the case of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, it's a plurilateral free trade agreement organized with, I think, 11, or now with Japan in the fray, I believe it's 12 nations taking part in the negotiations. And so far there have been some 17 rounds of negotiations that have taken place in various capitals of the world, all under extreme, high security and surveillance and things like that. So obviously, goes without saying that there's no media reportage of this, and it lacks transparency. So that's worrying. So we don't actually know what is going on, behind the scenes at these negotiations. And what we do know from the Trans-Pacific Partnership, what we do know about it, has come from leaks, various leaks from different insiders that shed a little bit of light into what the ramifications of the trade agreement will be. And they will be very far-reaching and certainly very negative for the people of the region, especially as more and more people learn about it. I noted in that article which you brought up that the strongest bastions of resistance have been in Japan. We see a lot of movements from the agricultural communities and different unions, the rice farmers and things like that, who have opposed it primarily because it directly threatens their livelihoods if those tariffs are going to come down, and those industries won't have any kind of protection, and it will not be able to compete internationally. So that is one point. And in Malaysia, I noted in my article that now we see people on both sides of the political spectrum, figures from the former heads of the ruling party, which still wield a lot of control today in Malaysia, and also members of the opposition who are equally loud, in their criticisms of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And what will it do exactly? Some of the things that I pointed out in my article are pretty far-reaching. So it would basically prevent countries from banning speculation, capital controls, and other very risky financial instruments, while at the same time, what it does is prevents these countries from enacting capital controls, which are an internationally recognized, very legitimate form of monetary management. So if we look at, I brought this up the last time I was in the Corbett Report, but if we look at a little bit of recent Malaysian history during the 1997 financial crisis, it was Mahathir Mohamad, who's now the very ardent opponent of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, who enacted capital controls that safeguarded Malaysia's ringgit and allowed Malaysia to basically bounce back, a lot quicker than a lot of those other countries. So there is value in a lot of these financial forms of the management. So aside from that, it's far-reaching. Only very few of the chapters of the Trans-Pacific Partnership deal with actual trade. The rest of it deals with things like patents, intellectual property rights, and things that would certainly raise the prices of generic medications, you know, because of the violate U.S. patents and other patents. And it would also stifle how we share digital information and doing the sort of work that we're doing, and more so what you're doing, which deals with a lot of maybe you might cite like an Al Jazeera news story or a BBC news story in one of your videos, and perhaps that might be flagged, you know, if there's some new IP legislation that's enforced. But it basically will prioritize the signatory countries to it will make those countries prioritize things like cracking down on intellectual property rights. And there are numerous other sweeping elements to the Trans-Pacific Partnership which will fundamentally alter the way international trade is conducted between those signatory countries, primarily in the sense that it creates a higher judicial authority than the national governments in those countries. You know, so if you're a signatory country, you're basically signing your country away to an international tribunal that has its allegiance to the UN and the World Bank. So I guess we could say it's a step towards global governance, certainly, but it is a corporate-style global governance. And I think, you know, people on the in the alternative media community have been for years talking about the formation of different regional trading blocks and things like that. And I'm not so sure if it'll be done through unions like I'm not sure if we'll see an Asia-Pacific Union in the same way that it will operate like the EU, but I think maybe in ways like using free trade agreements, these are the ways that this sort of global governance regime is going to be concocted.
And it would probably be more effective and insidious because of that, rather than being an open thing, an institution that could be openly opposed like the EU. Let's talk about the secrecy behind this deal, which has been just phenomenal, including even extending into to Congress, which is pretty amazing in the U.S. context, because, of course, this is a treaty that is going to be altering even the laws of the land so that, for example, corporations will have more ability to sue governments. Because of trade deals, etc. So, for instance, recently we had Representative Alan Grayson come out saying, I saw the secret trade deal. There is no national security purpose in keeping this text secret. This agreement hands the sovereignty of our country over to corporate interests. Can you speak a little bit to that issue of the secrecy surrounding this and the way that it's been invoked?
Well, sure. I don't know a great deal about the Senator Ron Wyden. You know, in fact, I had a lot of people emailing me for bringing him up in my article, probably because he's certainly no angel. But he is someone who is, I believe, has something to do with the international trade. He has some authority in that department, and he's basically prevented from seeing the draft text. So that kind of goes to show you, if members of Congress don't have the authority to review what the United States is negotiating, you know, it certainly raises more than an eyebrow. If we look at what Wyden said in his statement to Congress, he was speaking about how Big Pharma and the Motion Picture Association of America and all these other various multinational corporations, U.S. corporations, and their representatives are the ones who have access to the bill. They're not the bill, but the draft text, and they're the ones designing it. So certainly the secrecy is enormous, and it's not any better in any of the countries on this side of the world. And recently, here in Malaysia, just to speak about the domestic situation, Prime Minister Najib recently won a very controversial election, which the U.S.-backed opposition, or we can say an opposition that was headed by a figure that was once very close to the U.S. establishment, challenged the election results in a very similar way to what we saw unfold in Venezuela. You know, just a blanket denials, you know, or blanket accusations, rather, of mass fraud, which I don't think there's very strong evidence for. But anyway, Najib is in a very tough position, you know, and I believe we interviewed Dr. Mahathir Mohamad together last time you were in Malaysia, and he did mention that Najib was a weak leader, you know, and for these reasons, I believe that he doesn't really have a lot of political capital, and he's trying to please everyone, so he's honoring the Trans-Pacific Partnership negotiations, and That's what's going on. But I think what he is not privy to is the fact that there is a tidal wave coming in his direction because of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And that is, you have Mahathir Mohamad's camp, who was former prime minister of Malaysia for 22 years, still wields enormous control over the political landscape of the country. And you also have the opposition, which has a almost monopolistic control over social media and young people, and can certainly mobilize young people if they so chose to. So you have these two forces coming at Najib at the same time. So there is a lot of pressure. And we see now in the party-owned newspapers and things like that, that there's increasing criticisms of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. In Malaysia, you have members of the business community that are not happy at all. I recently attended a Russian embassy celebration for Russian National Day a couple weeks back, and there I mingled with some members of the Malaysian Foreign Ministry, and they told me basically on a just very casual basis that everyone they're getting so much trouble from the Trans-Pacific Partnership because everyone is criticizing it. So I was quite, happy to hear that, actually, because there's a lot of dissent happening within the party itself, and it could very well present Najib with maybe some people trying to take his job, with the upcoming internal party elections. So he's catching a lot of flack because of this, certainly. So it's a problem.
Well, let's talk about that opposition and the tidal wave that's coming, because this may be coming to a head as early as next month. The next round of talks are happening there in Kuala Lumpur. Can you tell us about the vibe on the ground there and what we can expect as this starts to hopefully hit the headlines there in Malaysia in a bigger way?
Yeah, sure. So basically what I'm filling a lot of my time with these days is I'm working with some Malaysian NGOs, some civil society groups, the most prominent being the International Movement for a Just World, which is headed by Professor Dr. Chandra Muzavar, who's a prominent intellectual, speaks on various international issues, and maintains some very principled policies when it comes to these issues. So I'm working with him, and we're hoping to collaborate with the Perdana Global Peace Foundation, which is Mahathir Mohamad's foundation, primarily to raise awareness about the Trans-Pacific Partnership. So that's what I'm doing, and we hope to form some kind of an international seminar before the end of the year, before this this law or this free trade agreement is expected to be passed. So we're working in that way to try and raise awareness about it. But I'm sure in the coming weeks, because the Trans-Pacific Partnership talks are going to be held in Kuala Lumpur, there's obviously a spotlight on that. So I'm sure in the coming days we'll see more critical opinion pieces and editorials published in the mainstream press. In fact, that's something that I'm going to be trying to contribute to. I have published in local papers here in Malaysia before, so I am intending to write something on the talks, in the coming weeks. So hopefully that exposure gets out, and people in Malaysia will have an honest debate about whether they want to take part in it. And of course, the opposition here has been raising questions. And I mean, it's very curious that they've only opposed it after they lost the elections. I personally have a feeling that they probably would have not opposed it, or at least as much, had they won the elections. But anyway, that's for a different discussion. But the main qualm they have with it is, of course, the enormous secrecy around the whole process of discussion. So that's fairly understandable, and I can't disagree with the qualms that they've raised and their concerns. They're the same as my concerns. So hopefully, I think the Malaysian government should be given some credit, because if we look at, for example, the situation with the Occupy Gezi protesters in Turkey and also the crackdown in Brazil. Those governments have handled the situation in a heavy-handed way, and we wouldn't know because international media has not really been covering it, primarily because there's been no violence. There have been tons of protests here in Malaysia since the conclusion of the elections in early May. I mean, dozens of rallies, hundreds of thousands of people showing up. I mean, the opposition can really mobilize a crowd here. But the Malaysian government handled it very well. It did not crack down. There's been very few arrests, no police violence. This is very telling that if there's no police violence, the international media tends not to cover it. So this is why no one has really heard about it. So I think there should be some credit. And I think the Malaysian government is not a government that is so illiberal that it prevents any kind of public debate about these sorts of issues. So one would hope that there will be space to oppose it, you know, in the mainstream press. And that's what I'm going to try and at least get my foot in the door with.
Well, I certainly hope that you're successful with that. But for the average person out there listening, whether in Malaysia or in Japan or in Canada or wherever it is, who are concerned about this, and there are people from all across the spectrum concerned about this for different reasons, as you mentioned, Japanese farmers or people in Malaysia concerned about the cost of medicine, et cetera, or anyone anywhere concerned about the internet and the free flow of information. There's lots of reasons to be opposed to this. What can people do to become a part of this opposition movement? What can they do to make their voice heard on this issue?
Right. Well, this is something that I've been a question I've been playing with in my head as well. And one of my ideas, you know, once my kind of work goes a little bit more into the in the field type of activism, right now it's really sort of behind the desk writing, you know. But what I think regular people can do is maybe find some information about the Trans-Pacific Partnership, create a couple bullet points, maybe a small document, translate it into the local language if you're not an English-speaking country, and stand outside of a populated area and pass out some documents and tell people about the Trans-Pacific Partnership. You know, memorize a few bullet points, talk about it, get to understand the issue, and just tell people about it. It's as simple as literally just telling your friends and people who you think would benefit from the information. I mean, nowadays our generation, our age group people, are not really keen to talk about anything so serious. You know, so people are not so excited to hear about it. A trade deal, which is basically quite bland, you know, seemingly, but there is a lot in there that we should be concerned about. So I think the easiest way to start is a on-the-street sort of activism, but if people are too shy to do that, at least just share articles about the Trans-Pacific Partnership on your social media sites, and I mean, it's certainly more more useful than people posting pictures of their food or whatever, Justin Bieber's haircut, who knows what people are listening to or onto these days, but certainly the TPP is very important. So at minimum, at least share information if you're not going to go out and be out in the street handing out flyers or doing whatever. So that's what I would say.
Well, I couldn't agree more. And for people who are incredulous about the effect that that can have, they only have to think of the fact that all of the major free trade deals in the past several years have been brought down largely by people becoming active and aware about these issues. That's the first step in the process. And whether it's the Free Trade Area of the Americas or the SPP or whatever it is, there's been a number of major deals that have been scuppered because people got motivated and active and started to become aware of it. So we are all links in that chain of spreading this information around and getting people on board. And I think they've learned their lesson, which is why this is so secretive and why they're trying to keep it so much under wraps. So the answer has to be trying to spread awareness and information about this. So I agree completely on that point. Let's shift gears a little bit, because there's other things afoot in the Asia-Pacific region and around the world generally that are worth looking into, including, of course, this interesting Edward Snowden story and the manhunt that's going on now, et cetera, et cetera. This is interesting because it starts to touch on the geopolitics between a lot of the big players here, including China in the U.S. and Russia in the U.S. And I know that recently you were writing specifically about the China/U.S. cyber war and that sort of topic. And now we have Snowden coming out with documents showing how the NSA has specifically hacked into computers, even civilian computers, on the Chinese mainland and in Hong Kong. So pretty interesting escalation of things coming just a few weeks after Obama and Jinping met specifically about this cyber war. What's your take on this? Can you set the scene, set the stage for us about what's really taking place between the U.S. and China on the cyber front at this point?
Right. So basically, a few days before the whole PRISM thing leaked, I did this article with my column on RT, looking at the situation, these allegations that China is the biggest violator of the U.S. IT, sovereignty, if you will. So the White House has been claiming that China has been, hacking them profusely and causing U.S. companies to lose millions of dollars. And I didn't dismiss these accusations off the bat, but I pointed out in my article that there lacks a real smoking gun that we could definitively link Beijing to these forms of hacking. But as I noted as well, that I think as the United States is pivoting towards the Asia Pacific, I mean, if you read op-eds in the People's Daily or the Global Times, just important to keep up with because they reflect the official opinions of the Communist Party in Beijing, I mean, I think there is growing skepticism of the U.S. relationship and U.S. intentions in the region. So I don't think it's, I think it's basically plausible, you know, that the Chinese government could be trying to get some information about U.S. military technology. I mean, I think that's realistic at this point, but basically we don't have very strong evidence to corroborate that. And the other thing is that, you know, this thing with Snowden has completely blown the lid off this whole thing. What Snowden's leaks or the information that he has revealed, what it says is that it corroborates the Chinese viewpoints and Chinese position that they are actually the victims of hacking far more so than the U.S. is. You know, what Snowden revealed was that NSA and U.S. Intelligence has been hacking into things like Tsinghua University, is one of the most prominent universities in China. They've tapped into Chinese mobile communications networks, looking at millions of text messages that are sent in that country. You know, so I mean, it's just incredibly sweeping. You know, and of course the revelations about PRISM and all that. So if we look at the, for example, recent Global Times editorials that have basically said what Snowden is doing is a good thing. It benefits the world, and that the Chinese government basically recognizing that had they handled the Snowden position differently to benefit U.S. interests, public opinion would turn against them. And I hear that Snowden has become such an inspirational figure in China and in Hong Kong for understandable reasons. And we know Beijing certainly doesn't have an appetite for any types of figures, you know, who would come out like a Chinese Snowden, for example. But of course, going a little off topic here, we know if Snowden was Iranian or Chinese, he would be called a hero in the United States, and he would welcome with open arms. So the whole thing is just an exercise in hypocrisy, and you know, I think it's U.S. hypocrisy at its best. You know, this country which opens itself with open arms to dissidents and various hasn't cooperated with the various extradition requests from other countries too. So it's no better, you know. And yet it is, you know, this model for human rights as it postures itself as, and it's chasing this nonviolent person around the world, this global cat and mouse game. So it's embarrassing for the Obama administration, perhaps the most notable embarrassment. So personally, I couldn't be any happier with the situation and what Snowden has, you know, come out with. I think we look at the early days of the Patriot Act, as I talked about in my recent article, which is not yet published, but I brought up the Patriot Act in a sense that it lowers the bar pretty drastically. You know, you didn't need probable cause to investigate someone. You know, you basically just needed to feel that they were suspicious, and then you could, you know, basically spy on them and wiretap them, and that was obviously very controversial at the time, and then everyone, you know, railed against the Bush administration for this. And I mean, PRISM is just, I mean, it's just so sweeping and overwhelming in contrast to even the Patriot Act. I mean, it's far more than I think what anyone really was thinking that the government was up to. I mean, it was just an incredible disclosure, you know, looking at just the immense kind of ability of the NSA to probably have access to this conversation, you know, and I mean, doing what we do, if we look at some of the specifics, we are both figures outside of the United States who may talk to Americans, and we may be listened to, and our Skype calls may be monitored, and obviously doing the sensitive political work that we do. I mean, I'd be surprised if we weren't being monitored by different U.S. intelligence groups. And the thing is, PRISM, it is about combating terrorism. The only thing is that Washington's definition of terrorism very different from our definition of terrorism. So Washington would therefore, under the guise of fighting terrorism, would put libertarians or Occupy protesters or activists or dissidents into the same basket as terrorists. So this is a very convenient pretext to crack down on dissent. And as I noted, the CIA is always very hyperactive. So they want a file on everyone. And this is what PRISM is all about. They want to be able to make a case on anyone, to pressure anyone. And if you have years and years of phone calls and email exchanges, you can whip something together and at least make a person look suspicious, especially it helps if you own most of the global media. So this is the situation where we've come today. The Snowden saga is incredibly interesting to watch, I think it's not going to end quietly, certainly.
Well, that's right. It is interesting to watch at any rate. And we do know from the other NSA whistleblowers and people like Mark Klein with AT&T, we do know that they have been tapping all communications flowing into the United States for several years now. And we now know that they're able to store all of that at their Utah data center. So it is more vast than most people could even begin to imagine. It sounds like the stuff of Hollywood sci-fi. But moving back to the geopolitical take on this, where do you think things are likely to go between the U.S. and China from here, especially after Snowden did leave Hong Kong with impunity, and now Russia also trying to say that they're not going to expel him? This is pretty big moves on the geopolitical stage, standing up to the big bully on the block.
Certainly. And before I answer that question, I just want to note, I've seen some of your Corbett report reports where you put, this little piece of cardboard over your iMac, on the camera. And because of that, I started doing that. And I certainly understand why, because we don't know who's watching and who's listening. I think these are MacBooks and all of these things, have embedded microphones. We never know who's listening. And it sort of makes one paranoid, but Snowden proves that there is sufficient grounds to be paranoid. Anyway, so to the geopolitical playing field here. So now it was very interesting that this whole disclosure happened while the meeting was taking place between Xi Jinping and Obama in California. And that meeting, of course, was all handshakes and smiles and good diplomacy and whatever. But behind that facade, we see things are really coming at a crossroads. And I was speaking to some Malaysian professors on the issue, and they all think that this is a sign, ever more signs of an increasingly multipolar world, where you have major countries, that are willing to basically assert themselves and stand up to the U.S. and basically allow the empire to be poked in the eye, so to speak. So I think, obviously, with the China situation, their decision to... I'm sure it's a decision from Beijing to let Snowden, leave Hong Kong. And we have some reports saying that the Hong Kong government officials met up with him and said, listen, you're free to go. So the hand of Beijing is definitely there. And I think, their Global Times op-eds talked about extracting information from Snowden. And, of course, in the U.S. media, there's chatter that Snowden would defect to China and, sell our secrets to the Chinese. But, who knows? I think Snowden, he claims to have only released information that was for the public good, things like the prison program. I talked about in my not-yet-published article how if Snowden was really keen to make things difficult for the United States, so he would have perhaps revealed the location of clandestine CIA operatives in various parts of the world. And he could have really jeopardize the security of a lot of U.S. covert operations, which are probably doing far more insidious things than just tapping phones. But that would obviously represent something that is really dangerous for the people involved in that, no matter what they're doing is right or wrong. That's would be bad for the U.S. certainly. So he's not going that far, but he's releasing just enough. But we don't know if Snowden supplied the Chinese with anything. The Chinese talked about maybe using Snowden to their advantage to get some information, and understandably, the Chinese are very concerned. And I think if Snowden is giving away information that proves that the U.S. is acting outside of national or international law, that I think it's morally justifiable. And I would certainly like to know if I were on the receiving end and leading a country that was on the receiving end of those kind of attacks. So as the Global Times said, maybe Snowden is considered a fugitive by the U.S. government, but to much of the world, I think there's a lot of sympathy for him. I think the U.S.-China relationship is going to become a little bit more tense. I think we may see it going the way of the U.S.-Russia relations now, which increasingly more chilly. So I think Beijing is under no illusions, and especially with this whole, we're seeing louder and louder voices in the Chinese media calling the U.S. An eavesdropper and basically a shameless interventionist. And, I think the policy differences are irreconcilable at this point. And we'll see what happens, with things on the geopolitical chessboard, like if Washington goes harder, that comes down harder on Syria, for example. We don't know what the ramifications would be from Russia and China, but we have some idea, you know, based on their stance. But the Russian situation, I mean, we don't know how long Snowden is going to stay in Russia, but Putin has basically told him, you're free to go, but make it quick. You know, he doesn't want Snowden to basically overstay his welcome there, you know. But I certainly agree with Putin in this respect, and I would have done the same thing if I were in his shoes. And this picture says it all, this recent photo of Obama and Putin sitting awkwardly side by side, probably discussing Syria or some other issue which they have enormous disagreements over. And they're just sitting there looking at the floor. And, you know, it's just a terribly awkward photo, but it captures the mood of U.S.-Russian relations. And I think with all this stuff that we've seen over the past, you know, several months, I mean, the U.S. openly supporting opposition figures in Russia, openly funding NGOs that have cast doubt on the Russian electoral process, for example, trying to undo Russian diplomacy in Syria, this CIA operative with the wig and the compass. I mean, it's just this Snowden thing might be the, might be, or maybe not the Snowden thing, but maybe some future thing will be the straw that breaks the camel's back, and maybe you'll have a little bit of very muted diplomatic hostility between the two countries. And I think the situation is going in that direction. And if the U.S. continues to pursue its interests so narrowly, which it's only ever done, you know, then we'll see some similar things with the U.S.-China relationship, I think.
I think so. Well, we are dealing with such grim subjects a lot of the time, things like the TPP and international relations when it comes to things like Syria. It can be a bit overwhelming at times, and the temptation is there to kind of give in to the pessimism of it all. But in order to counteract that, in fact, I'm putting together a podcast episode for this Friday talking about some of the positive signs, things that are changing potentially for the better, at any rate. And I don't want to be Pollyanna-ish about this, but I think there are reasons for optimism. How about yourself? Do you see any signs, any trends, anything that's developing or on the horizon, any news stories that you're following, or anything that you would give you hope for the future?
Well, certainly, you know, it's after this whole Snowden episode, I think if we look at how the Patriot Act angered people and, caused the public pressure on the Bush administration, I think this issue with PRISM is finally waking some of the Obama bot people up, some of the people who have just swallowed everything that the Obama administration has said. So I think once people start fundamentally realizing that the Obama administration is just doing exactly what the Bush administration is doing, but so much more intelligently, and they're packaging a lot of the same imperialist stuff, and they're packaging it in a much more sophisticated way, and they're going about things in a not in an overt way, but in a covert way. And if we look at the conflict in Syria, how much U.S. media tries to obviously make it a domestic situation, it is a U.S. war, you know, certainly. And I think the more and more people realize these things, then we're heading in a better direction. There's cause for some optimism, but it's not just the U.S. that is the enemy of people who hold viewpoints like ours. I mean, I think we should have solidarity with lots of the people who come out, you know, and basically just call for a more equitable distribution of wealth in their countries, more freedom of expression. And naturally, it's, you know, people like us will have sympathy with a lot of these protesters, you know, in various parts of the world. So I think the fact that we're seeing such such momentum, protests, all over the world, very commonly, you know, anti-austerity protests, and again, people calling for, an honest solution to the increasing income disparity in various parts of the world. All of these things, and questioning global hegemony, of course, you know, all of these things are signs that perhaps things are moving in a better direction. But I think we are at the early stages. But you know, the power of the alternative media, we can see over the past couple of years. I got into alternative media and sort of the following the stuff that you're doing maybe 3 or 4 years ago now. And I think since that time, I mean, Corbett is almost a household name, I think, you know, and certainly other figures in the alternative media. I mean, RT, we can say, why write for is presenting a very alternative interpretation of world politics, and they are the most viewed news agency, on YouTube and all of these things. So there is undeniably increasing public interest and public awareness in things not being what the mainstream media in the West portrays them to be. So I think these are good things, and I think only through the work of the alternative media and other forward-thinking media establishments like RT and other sources like that. I mean, I think slowly the public opinion is changing. As we go into a more of a multipolar world, I think that is only going to accelerate. And I think the next few years of the Obama administration, I think it's going to look very different. And we're going to see a lot of public protest. And I think we're going to see a lot of his traditional supporters perhaps abandon him, hopefully, and just recognize him for what he's doing and recognize that the situation in the United States is really no better off. In fact, it's worse off. So the more people take notice of that, I think the more we'll collectively be in a better situation.
Well, I agree with you on that. And again, for people who are incredulous about how that works, I can say that it worked in my own case back in 2006 when the House went from Republican to Democrat, and immediately they took impeachment off the table for Bush and Cheney and all of that. I that was when the penny really dropped for me, and I saw it is all a game. It is all an illusion. So I'm sure there are more people who are falling out of that illusion now as Obama becomes the hope and change that never was. And I think you're right. I think there is at least the chance for a large-scale awakening right now. So I don't think people should underplay what's happening. And I certainly don't think Corbett's a household name, but RT and other outlets like that are having a definite impact on shaping a different discourse.
I also want to just head on one more point before we end. I think there is... we see kind of like a divide in some of the alternative media, primarily emanating from the United States. One end is coming at it from a more libertarian perspective, which is, I think, sort of the views you emulate. And I think someone maybe like Eric Dreitzer is someone more on the socialistic side of things, and maybe I would fall in that category. But I think where you contribute a Boiling Frogs post is a great sort of arena where, different views can come together. And no matter if we're talking about an imperialist ruling class or a globalist, a class, we're really talking about the same thing. So I think we should be wary of these divisions, between different discourses. And I mean, it doesn't matter at the end of the day if we have different opinions of economics and socialism and free trade and whatever. I mean, we stand, united in much of these issues. So the alternative media should really, just have more solidarity, I guess, and should be wary of these sorts of divisions. We really are on the same page, basically.
I agree. There's more in common between you and me than there ever will be between me and a Rockefeller or something like that. I think we have to keep the real enemies in mind, no matter what the individual differences on certain issues. I think we have to keep the bigger picture in mind. And there can be such a wedge driven between people on so many issues. And that wedge is obviously exploited by the powers that shouldn't be. So I think that outlets like Boiling Frogs Post are very valuable for drawing together people from very different parts of this, whatever spectrum may exist. Before we continue with that, I just want to wrap up the positivity of this by saying that for people who are interested in this, as I said, I'll be putting together a podcast episode this Friday. If you want to contribute to it, please send in your thoughts either by email or tweet them to me. I will be happy to read some of your thoughts on air about positive signs that we are winning this battle overall. But speaking of BoilingFrogsPost.com, I hear from a little voice twittering in my ear that you might be joining the team very soon.
I have been. I haven't officially announced that, but the show, my concept for the show is called Getting Critical, and primarily it's been put off for the moment. It's been put on hiatus for the moment because I'm planning to do a bit of traveling for a few months to go around, because I've been sitting in Malaysia doing a lot of work for the past few months and haven't really gotten out. So being the travel bug I am, I really want to get that out of my system, and I would feel a bit disingenuous if I started the podcast and then, I'm going to go away for a few months, I'm not going to do it. So I want to start it while I'm here, and I'm going to be focused on it. And, so that will come. But basically, the premise of my future show will be an interview-based show. And my articles tend to look really closely. I really like to go in depth. If I pick a country, for example, I like to really know about what the sentiments are on the ground and what the issues are and the dynamics of local politics. And I guess I can say I like to go a few steps further, a little bit more in-depth than maybe some other folks who cover similar issues. So my show, I would like to be a reflection of these things. So I would just choose guests that I think are engaging and going to offer that sort of thing, and covering various issues from trade, geopolitics, economics, philosophy even. So I have a lot of ideas, and when the time is right, I will unleash it, and I will join the Boiling Frogs Plus team. But until then, I'll be basically a writer. I've always liked writing. I think it's my medium of choice. I feel I can get my views out with the most clarity if I'm writing. So that's what I mean.
Well, I am definitely looking forward to that. I hope I didn't spill the beans on the podcast there. But at any rate, we're having some technical difficulties here at the end of the conversation, so we'll leave it there for now. Niall Bowie, once again, niallbowie.blogspot.com. That will be in a link in the show notes so that people can find your website. Niall, thank you so much for your time today.
Pleasure to talk to you, James. Be well, man.